And then there were four.
And then there were four. The four horsemen of the apocalypse are together.
Can I be pestilence? Can I be pestilence, please? Can I?
Weren't you pestilence last time?
Yeah, well, you're not famine.
You're definitely not famine. Mike's not famine.
No, you're going to die full, is what I'm saying.
Oh, really? Is that what you're saying? You're too fat for famine.
Greg is definitely war. He's got the beard for it.
He is definitely the warrior.
I did. I had my beard tied off tonight, Viking style. I took my wife's hair tie in. Captain Lou Albano of my beard.
So we got a lot of TV. We got a lot of drinks. We got a lot of film. But before we do that, let's roll the title sequence. Welcome to What We Watch When We Drink, a booze dancing media podcast featuring lively discussions about movies, TV shows, and anything else that we're watching while we drink our favorite boozy libations. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever else you get your podcasts. And you could also find us on boozedancing.com. And by all means, email us at boozedancing@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you and answer any of your questions.
All right.
Good evening, boys. We're back.
Good evening. Episode 10, What We Watch When We Drink. We're all here tonight, and we have a special guest, Mr. Greg Schwartz from
The Water, Water of Life film.
Oh, I thought you meant where was I physically.
Well, we're in all different parts of the world, aren't we?
Yeah.
How are we doing, Greg? Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Always.
Doing pretty well.
You're not a guest. It's like, come on over.
Your family. Your family. It's funny that he lives near me, but he's not near me. He's like near you.
Sort of.
Yeah, same time zone as you, not me.
4 hours away, 5 hours away. You're up at Lake George?
Yeah, I'm in Lake George, yeah.
Okay. Looks like you're having a fantastic winter, though.
Yeah, the lake's frozen.
Oh, wow.
People are out on the lake and snowmobiling, ice fishing. And
wow.
We were walking around on it. That's all I did on it. And
that's scary.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I grew up in Pennsylvania, so I'm used to four seasons, but not like this. I mean, this is I never walked on frozen. I grew up ice skating, but on rinks, not on lakes.
It always seemed a little bit dangerous to me.
Yeah, I can neither skate nor swim. So,
but I can definitely drown.
Yeah, oh, I could do that with style. With style. I'll go down clutching my bottle of whiskey.
So speaking of whiskey, we should see if anyone's drinking anything tonight.
Oh, wait. Was that a question?
Yeah, I throw it out for just general thoughts.
I think what you want to say is I think I should see what everyone is drinking tonight.
Oh, indeed.
Not if.
Or you should just say cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Okay. So where are we going to start off? What do you got there, Greg?
Drinking the classic Laddie. That's I'm drinking right now. I'm only going to have a dram of it. I might have something else, but yeah, I'm drinking the classic Laddie.
Now that's not the Laddie 10, though, correct?
No. That's a little different. No. This is the non-age statement.
Yeah.
Which I got to say, it's kind of fun though to go in that rabbit hole of the code on the back. I mean, it's there's like 70 different casks, and one of them was like re-racked. Five of the casks were re-racked four times. So it's. Like the intricacies of this vatting are amazing.
What do you got, Mike? What are you drinking?
I've got the SMWS Battle Axe.
Oh,
since we're with the man who made a little love note to Isla, I'm drinking some Isla.
Excellent, and you are a Battle Axe.
God damn.
I have the Paul John Oloroso Select Cast.
Very nice.
I have a little sample of that, so I'm going to try to finish it off.
And I have what do I have here? I have a K&L, 7-year-old Kalila. Very end of it. Got to finish it up.
You didn't like it at all, huh?
Yeah, I didn't like it at all.
All right. Well, gentlemen, cheers.
We're here to talk some TV and whiskey.
But wait, before we do that,
we want Greg to give us an update on the movie. What's up with it?
Well, to the dismay of some people, We've begun doing a lot of smaller events with like lots of whiskey clubs,
festivals. Who's the dismayers out there?
There's a surprising number of people who have written to us saying, wait, I missed it. I want to see the movie now. And we don't really have it publicly available at the moment. That's going to change. It's going to change soon, in probably about 2 weeks. But we've done so many different little events with specialty whiskey shops, whiskey clubs. In the last week, I did one in Prague. I did one in Norway. We did one, a couple in California. We're doing one tomorrow in Boston. You know, so it, we're kind of retailing this right now and trying to, you know, generate some groundswell, word of mouth. And it's going really, really well, but it's not necessarily, you know, as big right now as we were doing.
I think
that
I
was
saw,
a lot of lifting.
I think I was watching the last Zoom you guys did, I think, where it was just you guys, not any special guests. And I kind of remember you saying something about you guys had a different way of getting this thing out there in bulk, in volume, versus the Netflix and the Hulus and the Amazons. I know you don't want to probably mention that now, but is that still the same?
I'm happy to. Yeah. I mean, we have our own kind of custom platform now where we can do PVOD, video on demand, like true on demand. And we're doing that for a couple months. And then, you know, we will 100% wind up on Amazon, Netflix, or Hulu, or, you know, who knows. It's just, we don't want to do that yet because now we kind of can control this conversation and sort of ingrain ourselves more deeply in the whiskey world. And this is when we would have been going to whiskey festivals and film festivals with it. And so we're doing this. The plan is to do it until it doesn't feel like it's kind of sustaining itself anymore. And right now it's growing every day.
On the film festival circuit, can you get this thing into those festivals in this manner, the way you are? Are you trying?
You absolutely can. We're debating whether it's worth our time or not right now, to be honest with you. Because festivals are basically the same thing we're doing right now.
Yeah.
And this way, at least we can control how often we show it, to whom we show it, what we charge to show it. And we had a lot of luck with the tasting sets that we did. And, spoiler alert, I think we're going to do some more. And some of the clubs we're working with are doing their own, which is kind of cool. Like, we're helping them. Like, you know, that's not where we're trying to make our money back. You know, so when we did the tasting sets, you know, we may have made some money off of them, but they're not a big profit center for us. You know, they're actually a ton of work. So, you know, this way we can kind of keep creating that interactive narrative.
I'm guessing 2-3 years ago when you had this concept to make a movie, you never thought you'd be marketing it like this, I'm sure.
No, you know, I don't know if either of you saw or caught this today, but we do this thing every Friday now where I do a live Zoom with a different person each week. Yeah. So today I talked to Rab McAkern from the Brichlati Distillery, and, you know, he and I were talking about what we were kind of coming clean about the plans that we actually had for last May. You know, Brichlati was like, they were going to turn one warehouse into a movie theater. They were going to get searchlights and red carpets. And we were going to do a step and repeat. And the thing that really is heartbreaking to us as whiskey nerds is they were going to do a Valinche with our like kind of film, like the film, one of our logo treatments on the bottle.
And that just really cool.
Yeah. I was pretty excited about that.
So you mentioned Brichlati, and we talked about the movie a couple episodes ago, I think.
Yeah.
And for me, at least, it's a love letter to Brichlati. I think, you know, we can definitely see your love for Jim and for Mark and for the whole organization and the whole the whiskey, of course. Had you thought about ever just changing the focus and going 100% Brichlati and making it a Brichlati doc?
That decision to go to make them the A story was actually born during the shoot. It wasn't an idea going into the shoot. It was going to be 5 or 6 distilleries kind of evenly spread. And it just became apparent that there was so much drama there. Part of it is I love the whiskey and I think it's great whiskey and it tells the story of the whiskey of the last 20 years. I think they're much more influential than their size as far as what they've done. They've forced the whiskey industry to change in a lot of ways, you know?
Yep.
But that all came about while we were shooting the film, and then while we were editing the film, it kind of forced itself front and center. But I will tell you this, we have had a number of different, if you want to, this is on topic for this podcast, because this is about TV. We've had a number of TV distributors, especially in Europe, talk to us about showing the film on television there, but every network in Europe broadcasts in hour long chunks. And they said we would need to do an hour long cut down. So we've actually had some conversations about if we had to do that, would we cut Brichlati down and then make it all 5 even, or would we cut everything else out and just make it a story?
Just make it Brichlati, right?
It's a decision we haven't had to make yet, fortunately. I mean, it wouldn't become the film. It would just be some alternate version. You know, docs always have alternate versions and stuff. So that's just, you know, something that might happen there. But the love letter part of it really just kind of was as we discovered it. It just felt right.
And it's such a good story. And the principal parties are so accessible.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of lends itself to making it into a story. I mean, it was really great. It really was. You know, if you didn't know anything about a Brooklady, it's hard to say you don't know now.
Well, you know what really made it come front and center, to be honest with you, is Mark Grenier.
Yeah.
Is because we knew ahead of time we had Jim, and we knew we had a lot of Jim. And Jim's a great story in his own right. But then to have the other side of that coin, and then when he was willing to spend time with us, then it was like, okay, now we can really, you know, have kind of play this out as a two-hander. And I think it really worked. And it really kind of gave the story shape that hasn't been really told elsewhere before.
Not at all. And I think if you had just one of them, it would have been odd. And it would have been like my story or one side of the story.
And
unfair almost in some ways. Yeah. And this really rounded it out. And I don't know that we've ever seen them both together in one story or even an article in the way that you guys allowed them to talk and get their opinions and feelings out about the whole story.
Our marketing director has asked me no less than 45 times, could we get a Zoom with both of them together?
They were never together through any of the shoots?
No.
Mark was in Ireland, you know, and Jim was in Scotland. And no, they were never together.
Mark is an interesting character. And seeing him on the Zoom with you guys was really interesting. Seeing him, not even in the film, he was really loquacious. He wanted to answer every question. He said he would keep talking the whole evening. He was amazing. He's a very personable person.
I didn't realize that he wasn't behind selling Brooklady. I didn't realize that.
You know,
and
it's
then
funny,
you find out, you know, you walk into your baby and they tell you you're out. Yeah, you're out. What do you mean I'm out?
You know, I'm going to say in the first 4 days after they sold, people swarmed attacking him, assuming he was behind it. There was he was attacked on Twitter. He was attacked in the whiskey media. And he was the only one standing against it.
Said no.
Yeah. He came out pretty quickly about, but he still was attacked that he was the guy not voting for this. Those two guys, we could go on forever about these guys. Their second and third and fourth chapters of their lives are like lifetimes for most people. Jim could have been retired 5 times by now.
And you know, it's funny. I talked to him this morning because he and I are doing some events together next week. And so I talked to him this morning and he said, I'm trying to be retired here. And I thought that was very funny.
He's doing a terrible job.
Yeah,
he is unsucceeding. He is not good at it. What does his wife say about that?
I think she would like him to retire.
I'm guessing, yes. But then he hang around too much and, you know, we know how that goes.
I was talking to a woman this morning from work, on the day job. You know, the one that pays the bills, that buys me the microphone. And we're talking about, go hang with your family, quality time. And so I'm like, all right, it's almost been a year. So 24 hours, 24/7. I've only left to go to the office once. So 24 times 3, 8,760 hours. But that includes sleep. So,
yeah.
Well, that's the quality time when you're asleep.
Oh, yeah. or when they sleep.
I saw someone write on Twitter the other day, and I thought this was very funny, that said, it's weird to me that next month is March because last month was March.
It's so funny you said that.
I just hear in my head, hey there, campers, as we're starting Groundhog Day all over. Yeah.
I said last night at this perm event that we ran last night on Zoom for our synagogue, that it's just been one long perm because it's 1 year of perm. It started, and then the lockdown started, and perm's here again. It hasn't ended. Well, we're really glad that things are moving along with the movie, and we hope that we'll see other ventures coming from it. We know there's going to be a independent bottling version coming, correct?
And other people on our team were shooting yesterday. We did an interview yesterday for that.
Oh, that's great.
On location or?
In Scotland.
Excellent.
You know, our C camera. Guy Satchwell is his name. He was our sound mixer, but he also he didn't do it for us, but he's also a drone pilot and he shoots like B and C camera for stuff. He's just an a man in a van, as they call him in Britain. You know, he's got a van full of all the film gear he needs and he'll whatever you want out of the van. So anyway, he did an interview with it. This isn't a secret because I put a thing on Instagram about it yesterday, but he was interviewing Ian Croucher yesterday for us. We already interviewed him once, but we wanted some more. We couldn't get enough.
So that's a next year kind of thing, probably.
Yeah, I mean, look, if I could fly to Scotland tomorrow, I would. So yeah, and I think we'll be done. If the world were to open up in the next month or so, we'd be done with this by the end of this year. But otherwise, it's probably early next year. Yeah.
Well, we are excited. We're highly supportive. We all like the doc, and you like whiskey, right? All right, guys, let's move along and get into some television, huh? Let's talk about things that we watched recently first.
Greg, you're the guest. Go first.
Yeah. Go first.
What have I watched recently?
These are things that you've kind of gone through. Maybe not that you're in the middle of, but you've already kind of gotten through.
Lupin. Nice.
How do you like it?
We finished it tonight, actually, a couple hours ago. My wife and my father-in-law and I finished it. You know, I like it. I don't love it.
I really liked it a lot. I thought it was really
good. I got Brittany's the one who got me into it. And was it when we were with you guys when she was talking about it? I forget. Somewhere she was talking going on about it. My father-in-law, my wife, I think, loved it. And I did like it. I looked forward to it. But I wish I spoke French because I have a feeling I'd like it more. It was some of the dubbing. It did a great job with the dubbing.
Oh, wait. Did you watch it with the dubbing?
Well, I don't speak French. Did you watch the subtitles? Okay. Yeah. No, we watched it dubbed.
Oh, no, the subtitles are much more interesting. The dubbing is usually pretty awful.
Well, and it's some of the voices were just like, I would have rather at least they gave them French accents. And then with the dubbing, like some of them kind of sounded like, the one guy sounded like Danny DeVito, you know, but he didn't look like Danny DeVito.
Which one sounded like DeVito?
Was it, that's hilarious.
The older, like the Dumont, like the older cop.
Oh, yeah.
Now who's the commissioner? Like the guy who they got to do the voice, it was like they got Danny DeVito to do it. And
maybe they did.
You know, so that was my problem with it. But because I thought it was really well made, very slick, you know, and very fun in a sort of Ocean's 11 kind of way. And
exactly. Yeah, he was fantastic, I thought. I thought he was really
good. Yeah, no,
he was great. I'll say it again. He is the Idris Elba of France.
Yeah. He may be. Well, it sets up for a nice second half of it, whenever that's going to come up.
I think it's coming in the summer, so I'm dying.
Oh, really good. Probably a six episode thing. Yeah, I liked it too. What else?
We watched the Pembrokeshire Murders. That's brand new. It just ended. It's BritBox here, it was like a week behind. It was a week here. It was only a week behind the BBC,
okay,
which is new for them, I think, to be on that quickly. But it's like a mini series, like I think a three 90 minute episodes about an actual Welsh serial killer in the early 2000s.
Was it a documentary
it's a scripted drama. Watch that. I'm trying to think what else we've watched recently that would be new. One of you guys go.
Okay. Yep. Okay. What do you got, Mike? What you been watching?
I tried to watch Firefly Lane and, my daughter was home from school. So we were watching that. And it just, what a stinker. It's just not good. They had two women who are clearly not 14 playing 14-year-olds. And then as they migrated to college, they replaced the two women who look like they're actually college age with two women in their 40s and had them in college. And you're like, okay, but you just gave them wigs. They still look like they're 40, and those other two women could have played that role. It was very strange. Katherine Heigl, who was very good in the very beginning of Grey's Anatomy, I'm just not a fan. She's just not particularly good. No, I really like the other woman, Sarah Chalk. She was on Scrubs. I really like her.
Yeah.
But the show is not very good. And then we watched WandaVision with the boys, and this is the This leads up, I think, some of the things that are going on in this might be in the new Spider-Man movie, and then that moves into the next Doctor Strange movie, so you kind of have to watch everything, the TV and the movies now. And the WandaVision was very good.
It looked a little wacky.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things where it's moving into this, you know, if you saw the Spider-Man cartoon, the multiverse, the first 20 movies from Marvel all led up to the big bad Thanos, and everything was kind of continuity checked, everything kind of ran into it. And now this next group of movies is moving into this multiverse. And I think everything's going to somehow link up to multiple versions of everybody. And It's going to be a lot of weird stuff going on, but the boys really enjoyed it. And I find the character for the Scarlet Witch to be very interesting. And Catherine Hahn plays the big bad in this. She's really good. I mean, she's a crazy person. Good. She's come very far from sweaty balls, but she's very good. She's really very good.
The MCU is, it's tough not to be a little bit confused by it all.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
so much going on.
Yeah.
And much like Star Wars, there's just so much content and it all sort of runs together. Maybe it's something for people much younger than me. and I can only pick and choose things out of it because I can't do it all.
Yeah.
Were any of you guys comic book guys growing up?
Yeah. See, I was not.
I was a little bit.
I got into the Marvel Comics world and they, you know, what they're doing now is what they always did in the comics. Yeah. Not always, I guess. In the 60s, they didn't. But in the 80s and 90s, they did where there'd be four different Spider-Man issues a month, and they were all different storylines, but then they would have interweaving different storylines, and you go and they do cross episodes and stuff. Like it's funny to me that it took them 30 years to figure out they could do that with movies and basically lock people in.
Yeah, well, I think a big part of it was the way they sold off all the properties.
Yeah.
This went to Sony, this went to Warner Brothers, this went here, this went there, and you couldn't do a lot of the crossover stuff because we don't have rights to that character. They're
IP,
Fox. We don't have those guys. And now that all those contracts have expired, I think they're able to put it all under the Marvel umbrella now, or at the very least, loan people out, which is what they're doing with Spider-Man. They're lending Doctor Strange to a Spider-Man movie so Spider-Man can come back to them.
There's a bigger picture going on, and having under one roof, you can kind of control that.
Do you know something interesting about that? The studio system from that time. A casting director I work with sometimes, I haven't worked with her in a few years, but we're friends, and her name's Bonnie Gillespie. She told me something really interesting that for the longest time, there were very few jobs in movie production that were dominated by women, but casting always was up to and including now. The overwhelming majority of casting directors are still women. And she told me it was born of the studio system because she said all of the different contract players, I don't mean the stars, but I mean the contract players, they would basically their day-to-day job, they'd be kept in different houses on the lot. And there'd be a house of like 20 something women and a house of like the cops, if you're going to want a cop, you know? And the studio started to put a receptionist in each house and they would call and say, we need six cops. And those receptionists, over time, started to develop, okay, they want a cop. This guy is, okay, it's Boston. We're going to get a, you know, they started to form opinions and taste, and those became the first casting directors, and they had just started as receptionists.
Interesting. That's funny.
And they knew those characters better than anyone.
Yeah.
And I just find that absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
Huh.
I was going to bring this up at some point in this conversation today. I had this loaded and ready to go, but I'll bring it up now. I'm rewatching The Wire right now. And
Ange got me on it years ago.
Well, you know what? Let's save that for the end when we start talking about like what makes a show memorable.
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Yeah, because I want to get into that. So.
Ange, what you been watching, Andrew? What did you finish watching?
So, I finally, Your Honor finished 2 weeks ago. Yeah. Oh, we had to see it to the end, though. We just had to see it to the end. There were so many loose ends and so many loose threads and so many, like, it was just a train wreck of a show.
Is it set up for something more, or is it?
No, I think it's done. I think it was it. It was a mini series, but there was some satisfaction.
When it goes off the rails, it's hard to bring it back, right?
Yeah, there was no way he was getting out of this, and thankfully they killed off somebody. It's like, oh my god, thank God somebody caught a bullet.
Not Cranston.
No, not Cranston. But it was, you know, that's all I'll say. I don't want to spoil it in case you do watch it, but it was, you know, it wasn't that good. Wasn't that good? So we watched that. I finished Love and Anarchy last week. That was good fun, except for the ridiculous language.
Don't make fun of my Scandinavian TV.
No, things. Not at all. They make some good stuff. They make some really good stuff.
It's a very good show. I liked it a lot.
And plus, there's a lot of great actors that have come out of there.
Yeah.
I mean, look at Stellan Skarsgård, for God's sake.
Oh, I meant the actual show, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, the show's great.
Is it the same 12? Like Israel? Is it the same?
No, thing? I think there are more than – there might be more Scandinavian actors than in Israel.
Because they could pull from five countries and just call it Scandinavia.
That's right. Norway, the Dutch, doesn't matter. Get it all kinds.
But Swedes. Not Finland, though, because Finland only has the market cornered on like race car drivers and like skiers, I think. Because if you want to win,
there's a lot of hockey goalies.
Right. That's true. A lot of Finnish hockey goalies. I thought that was a really good show.
It was an interesting show. It was really, really interesting. She was great.
It's funny how some of these shows, and I've got a couple too, that are they almost would feel, if they were made in America, they'd feel like network formula shows.
Right.
But when they're done in another language or from another country, they don't feel like something you'd find on Tuesday night on ABC. They just seem less networky. Maybe exotic. Maybe that's right.
You know, it's a different locale. It's not, you know, New York or Toronto posing as New York.
Yeah.
Or, you know, some other place posing as somewhere else. It's, you know, it's a different place. You're in Stockholm.
Would we be excited about The Water of Life if it was all done in Kentucky?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it would be good. That would be good.
I might not be as excited about it, but
you're not a bourbon guy.
No.
But the personalities in Kentucky are pretty big. You know, you get your Booker Nose and
if it was all made at MGP. No, not so much.
But Love and Anarchy was fun. That was a good show. And I think there is going to be a second season, is there not?
I don't know. Hope so.
Yeah, so I finished Love and Anarchy, and then I decided to start watching a couple of movies. So I watched Judas and the Black Messiah on HBO Max, and also watched Nomadland on Hulu. And last night I watched Queen and Slim.
What's that?
That's with Daniel Kaluuya, and I don't know the name of the woman who's in it, but the writer was actually, if you remember on, what was the Aziz Ansari show? Master of None.
Oh, Master of None.
Master of None.
His black woman he was friends with, who's a lesbian.
I know who you're talking about.
Right. Well, she wrote it. She wrote the show. She wrote the movie. And the woman who directed, I think actually directed the Thanksgiving episode on Master of None, where she comes out to her parents. And I think she's done a couple episodes of Insecure on HBO, and apparently she's a music video director. So Daniel Kaluuya plays he's a guy, and he's on a date with a woman, and she's an attorney. They're in Cleveland. And, you know, the date's not going well. They're in a diner. They're driving home. She's monkeying around with his phone. He looks like the car's swerving, so he gets pulled over by a cop. And he's not in the best part of Cleveland. And the cop's a little bit, what do you want to call it? High strung. And the woman he's on a date with is an attorney. And she's getting all pissed off because, you know, the cop is like assuming he's drunk and he's giving him a really hard time. So, of course, she's getting in the cop's face. And one thing leads to another. She gets shot. The cop winds up shooting her. He gets the gun away from her and winds up killing the cop. And then they go on the run. And then they decide to, instead of turning themselves in, they go on a 5-day on the run thing, trying to get away from the cops. And it becomes this big, huge manhunt. And then while all this stuff is going on, there's footage in the car of everything that's going on, the whole incident. And it goes viral. And it gets all, you know, and it starts, you know, all these protests. And they're almost like folk stars. Heroes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the cop was clearly in the wrong in all this. And he was really just defending himself.
Is it based on a true story?
No, I don't. I mean, I guess it's based on true stories.
Stories.
But not a particular true story. But it was pretty good. I want to say it was great. It was beautifully shot. And it was just kind of like a road trip. You know,
and that's a wide release movie, or is it HBO? Or
it's a couple years old. It was like 2019.
Okay.
But it's on HBO Max.
Yeah. It's on the Max.
It was interesting. Kaluuya was really good. I really like him. And I really liked him in Judas and the Black Messiah. That was a pretty interesting movie. Though it's funny, I was on the Facebook page for that podcast we like, and I posted how I liked it and all that. And one guy who I guess was really close to the civil rights movement, like in the late 60s and 70s, just went off on all the inaccuracies in the movie.
Oh, wow.
And two guys were going at it. It was just, I was like, all I said was I really enjoyed the movie. I don't know. And these guys are just like, because I think I used the word realism as opposed to realistic. And then he's like, look, there's just a lot wrong with the facts in the movie. And I don't think it was meant to be a historical, you know,
document
reenactment. Yeah. So, but it's a really good movie. Kaluuya was great. The guy who's in, what's his name now? He's in Atlanta. I can't think of his name. I can't think of the actor's name, but he was really, really good. It's a good cast. It's a pretty well-made movie. It was good.
Good.
And Nomadland was kind of weird. Do you know about this one?
Yeah.
I was going to watch it tomorrow night, actually.
Yeah, it was, you know, I actually watched it in two parts because I was watching it a couple nights ago. You know, it's not, what do you want to call it, cheery by any stretch.
No.
Because it's a bunch of people that have been, you know, they don't have money. They don't have jobs. They can't afford their homes. So now they're living on the road. Campers and vans and all this kind of stuff. And Frances McDormand was really good. The second half of the movie I liked better. So I'd say it was worth it. It was an interesting movie. But it's not what I would call, you know, a good time. But it is a very well-made movie.
Well, I had a couple. One that we talked about months ago, and I never got to it, but I finally did get through. Not get through, but watch Palm Springs.
On Hulu. What'd you think?
I loved it. It was really
good. Isn't it great?
It was fun. You know, movies, pretty much anything in the desert will make me happy. So seeing the desert was just awesome. I'm still not 100% pro Andy Samberg. But
yeah, he was really good in this, though.
He is really good in it.
He was really, really good. And it's good, though, because once you get the context of what's going on, you know, and how long he's been stuck in this world, you kind of realized why his character's so, like, unhinged in the beginning.
Yes. Yep. It was good. It was.
It's really, really good.
Interesting around Groundhog Day and, you know. Uh-huh.
Have you guys seen it at all? Mike, Greg?
No, I haven't seen it.
You should check it out. It's hysterical.
It'll get some awards, I believe.
It's fun. It's fast. It's great. It's beautiful to watch. It's just really, really good.
It's actually funny. I finished Caliphate, and one of the actresses, one of the lead actresses, is also in Love and Anarchy.
Right. One of the marketing assistant or the marketing director in Love and Anarchy.
Yep. And she's a Syrian woman who's trying to escape Syria, and her husband's in ISIS. And she's trying to get away, so she connects with a Swedish police officer on a cell phone. And it's a good war-torn movie. It's based on the three British girls who were radicalized, you know, like 10 years ago. And it's based on that story, and there's a radicalization story going on at the same time of some girls in Sweden. It all ties back to this woman in Syria trying to get out. And it's also set up for another season. I hope it comes back because I enjoyed it. This is kind of strange. Last night I was doing a little channel surfing and I came across Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And it was the last half hour or so of the show, of the movie. And I hadn't seen it in so long. And I thought, I'll just sit. What happened in the last half hour? I don't really remember. It's been a long time. And my first thought, I think my wife was nearby watching, she said, this movie can't be made today, could it? And I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe it couldn't make that movie. Maybe some of the parts would have to be changed. I think when we turned it on, Spicoli's talking to Mr. Hand about, you know, his future and taking his test in his bedroom. I don't know if that movie can be made again 30 years later.
I honestly don't remember it. I haven't seen it in probably 30 years.
I haven't seen it in a number of years. I mean, I saw it 5 or 10 years ago, but there's certainly things about it that likely wouldn't get made now. Certainly not by a studio anyway.
No, it seemed like it would be an indie movie.
I just did the same thing last night, just turning around channels and late at night and wound up watching Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
I've never seen that. That's the one with Johnny Depp.
Benicio del Toro. And Terry Gilliam directed it. It's a bit of a mess, but it's a joyful mess. You know, it's a very, very stylish mess, you know?
That's funny. See, I'm not a fan of Johnny Depp, though. That's my problem. I just, I don't know.
This always felt to me like a role he was born to play just because he completely disappears in that, you know, this sort of Hunter Thompson character, you know? And, I think Terry Gilliam was the perfect person to direct that movie. I don't know if this is true or not, but I always feel like Terry Gilliam's movies are very athletic movies to make. You know, they're not quiet thinkers. You know, there's like these big kind of rambling set pieces and.
Well, that's him. You know, I mean, that's his whole thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like he did all the cartoons for the Monty Python, right? And that's just basically.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, his brain exploding on camera pretty much.
Yeah. And fighting with studios to get his movies made for $100 million less than they cost.
He's made some good ones. There's a few I haven't seen in a long time, though.
Oh,
I would actually like to go back and see The Fisher King. It was on TV a little while ago.
I want to go back and see Brazil.
Yeah, Brazil. Brazil and Baron Munchausen again.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Did you see The Man Who Killed Don Quixote?
No, But I want to see. I have to put that on my list.
Did you see the
it's a mess.
Documentary, Greg? I'm sure you probably saw it. Lost in La Mancha. That was really good. I think it was, and it was actually a couple guys from Temple that filmed it.
They were hired to be the BTS team for that movie. Right. They were making the movie, and they were hired to shoot the behind the scenes footage for the movie. And then they wound up with the movie, and the movie didn't happen. Yeah, I liked that movie, that doc. But the man who killed Don Quixote was, I mean, it was a bit of a mess, to be honest with you, and more than I wanted it to be.
Was that actually in the theaters, or did it not get to the theaters and went right to video because of the lockdown?
I saw it. No, it came out in 2018. I didn't see it in a theater. I did see it at home. I know that. But, you know, it's, I don't know. You'd have to see it. It's, it's a thinker, to say the least.
So what's our next drink? Are you guys on your second?
Or? More whiskey?
I already poured my second one. I'm drinking the Benromic Batch 1 Cask Strength. Yes.
We got there, Mike.
I killed it.
Oh, that's a cool bottle.
I've got the Beaumont 18. Which somebody didn't like. Somebody turned his nose up to it. Said it wasn't quite his thing.
Me? Hey, hey, you know, it's not as good as the independent ones. I'm sorry. I've got a Glendronic 2007. It's the New York City cask.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I figure I still got this big sample. Let me dig into it.
I have the Benriach 12, the newer one.
The new one, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Three casks. The new label? Yeah, it's weird. I'm adjusting to the new label. I think I like the old one better, but
Do you know what I find very, very funny? People always confused Benromic and Benriach. And then but at least they didn't look anything alike. And then they both rebranded themselves 2 weeks apart and now they look alike as well.
Yes. That's funny. Yeah. Gonna be lots of confused people with that.
They hired the same branding company to work on the new logo.
I guarantee you someone had to have gotten fired at one of those one of the two. Because I think this will probably be the last Benromic I have with the old branding on it. You know, this always looked like a Pearl Jam album cover or something. You know, this kind of very 90s font.
I like that. It looked like someone actually wrote their name on the bottle. It was nice.
Yeah, no, I like it. I just found it funny that that happened to them both at the same time. I actually meant to ask Rachel Berry about that, but it didn't feel appropriate. it didn't feel big picture enough to our conversation. You know?
I gotcha.
Yeah, she probably has nothing to do with that, does she?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's move on. So we got whiskeys now. Anything that we're watching now currently that we're in the middle of that we want to talk about?
Well, I know, certainly.
And you were watching The Nick.
Yes. The Nick just dropped on our favorite HBO Max. And I kept hearing about it, and I've been on a bit of a Soderbergh kick lately. So I'm curious, you know, like I went back and watched Out of Sight, and I finally saw Magic Mike, and the guy is just, he's climbing on my list. He's making top five directors for me. He's up there. But yeah, so I was really curious to watch The Nick, because I tried to watch when it was first on. But I think the problem was, I wasn't as patient as I am now with watching a show. Like, if it didn't hook me in immediately, I would just kind of give up. And also, I usually would try to watch them late. And I would just get tired and just, you know, kind of just fall asleep. I watched the first two episodes. And it is really, really good. It's gross. And they don't shy away from things on the show by any stretch. I mean, if you're a little squeamish, don't be watching this one. It's just, it's crazy. And it's funny because it takes place like around, I think, early 1900s.
Yep. In New York City.
Yeah. New York City and the hospital down, I guess, is Lower East Side or like in the Greenwich Village or something like that. I guess the south part of Manhattan.
Yep.
And, you know, it's just amazing. I mean, you know, my day job is at a medical institution, and you look at this thing and it was just, not barbaric. No, it's barbaric. Yeah.
Compared to now.
Yeah, exactly. They just didn't have the tech. It's just
your $80 million picture is, you know, the gross clinic. That is The Nick.
Right. It's just
anesthesia.
Oh my God. It's just insane. You know, just the way it's done. It's beautifully made. I don't know where they shot it. I don't know if they just built up a bunch of sound stages for it or they're shooting it somewhere else.
I think they shot that show in New York.
Silver
Cup or something, yeah.
Right, so I guess they did the same thing they did with Boardwalk and just built up the sets.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, it looks fantastic. It really looks – they dropped a lot of money on this. They did not skip.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks good. And there's a couple of shots. There's, like, one scene in the first episode where Clive Owen's character, I guess, is he's a bit of a drug addict. He's got a bit of a problem with shooting up cocaine. And he's home, and I guess he's trying to break it, and he's got the DTs. So he's in bed, and he's just in all kinds of pain, and there's a big surgery coming, and they send the nurse to go get him. And this tracking shot of her just go running through town, climbing up the steps, climbing through the window to go get him, it was just really, really good. So I'm really curious to see where it goes. And then they've got then there's the whole racial angle, because they bring in a doctor who, you know, went to Harvard and studied right. in London and Paris, but he's black. And of course, they won't give him the time of day. And the benefactors that are pretty much pumping a whole lot of money into this hospital, electrifying the place, trying to modernize the building, are like, you got to get this guy on board. And, you know, they're just treating this guy like
crap. And he, as I recall, he worked in France or somewhere in Europe. So he had all these other new techniques that they had no idea about. Right.
Yeah. I mean, he's and he could fight. He can kick.
He's a star.
Yeah, he's great. He was really good. So I'm really curious to keep going with this. I'm really enjoying it. So yeah, I started that. Men in Kilts. Are we watching Men in Kilts? Greg, have you watched this?
What's Earth?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's only been two so far, right? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Two.
Yeah. Yeah. We've watched them both. Yeah.
I like that. Their chemistry is great. Beautifully shot. The locations are great. My only complaint is that I think it's too short. I think the episodes could be a little longer.
And yeah, and it's funny because the second one, you saw the second one, the sports one?
Yeah, yep. I did.
So at the end of it, they show all these shots of them playing other sports that they haven't played in the episode. So I was like, wait, clearly they shot this to be longer, and now they're just cramming random shots in at the end.
I don't understand why it's so short. Like even the first episode. You know, although I did like, they did spend a good bit of time at Laphroaig. So there was a
I did like that. Yeah.
That was kind of cool.
I like it and I'll keep watching it. It's a light little appetizer of a show, but I do think that they really want them to be Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon from the Trip movies. Some of their banter feels scripted to me. It just rings, you know, like they someone's like, "Oh, make jokes about this." You can almost hear a producer saying, "Make some jokes about this. Make some jokes." Whereas with Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, especially the first Trip. I've seen all four of those movies. I don't know if you guys have seen them all.
I haven't seen them.
Britain. So in Britain, they're not movies. In Britain, they're a TV show.
Oh, really?
They re-edit them for the U.S. market into a movie, and they cut stuff out. And if you watch them in the British form, they're longer. They're half-hour episodes. And they're just such good comedians, more than anything else, that their banter while they're driving around is just – I mean, you've probably seen the Michael Caine stuff. That's the thing that really kind of – have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
Ange? Michael Caine thing where they're arguing about who does a better Michael Caine impersonation, and the whole way through the movie they keep one upping each other on this Michael Caine.
That's funny.
But the first Trip movie, it's just the Trip as opposed to what are the other ones? Italy, Spain, and Greece now.
Okay.
They're all entertaining, but the first one is just really great. And it's very similar. It's just them driving around England going to different restaurants. And they have a very good chemistry together, because what they play is that they don't really like each other that much. They know each other, but they don't like each other, and that kind of gives it a nice tension.
So Men in Kilts, so when I'm watching it, I'm entertained the two episodes. Yes. But when I walk away from it, I'm kind of annoyed. It feels like an ad for Outlander. They got those Outlander clips in there the whole time, and it feels like they're zigzagging across the whole country to do this 1.5 hour episode, whatever they are.
Well, that was the thing with the first one. They were on the east coast of Ireland of Scotland, and they're saying it's day one. And next thing you know, they're in Ireland. Yeah. I'm like, they're not close at all. That's like a 6 hour drive, isn't it?
This has made no noise in the U.S. at all. But if you've come across it, I highly recommend. Have you any of you guys heard of Frankie Boyle? He's a Scottish comedian with a big red beard like my beard is now, but ginger, like proper. and he has a number of TV shows now in Britain where he's kind of like a Jon Stewart. You know, he has a lot of talk shows where he gets guests, and actually no, more like Bill Maher. He'll have guests on, and then they just make fun of politicians the whole time. But he just did a series called he's from Glasgow, and he just did a series called Frankie Boyle's Tour of Scotland, and it's really, really funny, and it's kind of structured similarly, but it's I just find him very funny and like aggressively offensive.
So that's more interesting to me because it's less whitewashed, right?
Mm-hmm.
He does a
good job of breaking the fourth wall. Like he'll say, and now we're going to cut to the part of the show where we watch me stare in the medium distance and a drone shot watches me sail away on a ferry.
Okay. Where is it available?
I want to say it was on BBC America, actually, where we watched it. But I may, you know, I may have a VPN and I may have a BBC iPlayer. I'm not saying I do. I just might. By the way, here, here's some, I should get paid for this pitch. You guys have Just Watch. It's an app and you enter any TV show and it, and you, when you create your account, it's totally free. You create your account, you list everything you have. Like I have HBO, I have this, I have this, I don't have this, I don't have this. Then when you enter a TV show, it immediately gives you a list of every place you can find your show. And if it's not any ones you have, it'll list the ones you don't have where you could get it. It's amazing.
Just Watch.
Just Watch. Okay.
But it, anyway, it's, it is somewhat structured like Men in Kilts.
Mike, you watching anything in the middle? You're in the middle of anything?
Well, there's a couple WandaVisions that are left. And then I think the Winter Soldier and the Falcon starts after that. So that'll be the next thing we pick up.
Okay.
And I don't know. Maybe I'll go back to Firefly Lane and see if it's
something. Just say no. Just say no.
Like Angelo, I can't stop. I have to watch it to its conclusion and then go, oh, that was a stinker. I should have stopped.
Oh, we're also watching WandaVision. We watched tonight's episode. And Catherine Hahn is fantastic.
Yeah.
Catherine Hahn is who was the closer for the Yankees for all those years?
Mariano Rivera.
She's the Mariano Rivera
of the MCU.
In general. I mean, she just comes in and she just steals the show. Yeah, she's good. She's really really good. She's highly entertaining. I like her.
Greg, you in the middle of any shows?
This is a weird one. I don't know. Have you guys seen Painting with John?
Oh, you know, I've seen it on who's the John Lurie? Is that who it is?
John Lurie, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now I've seen the pick for it. And I'm kind of curious.
I love it so far. I mean, I've watched three of them. I mean, they're just they're 20 minutes long, and they're just as weird as the day is long. But I just find them, you know, I actually really love his paintings. I love his names of his paintings. He's, you know, the music in the show is good. It's just it's a strange show, but I'll watch it through for sure.
He had one. What was it? Fishing with John?
Fishing with John. Ago? Yeah, that was the original. Yeah,
I never saw that either, but I think it's on Criterion. It's available.
Watch the one where he goes ice fishing with Willem Dafoe.
Oh, really? Oh my God, that's gonna be fantastic.
Right, that's a good pitch.
Well, I liked Lurie in the. He did a lot of the Jim Jarmusch. He did a couple of Jim Jarmusch movies, right?
Yeah, he did all the music for him and stuff.
Well, he was in Down by Law.
Yeah, and he wrote all the music for Down by Law too.
Okay, yeah, Down by Law is great. That's a great movie.
He also did two episodes fishing with Dennis Hopper.
Oh, that's gotta be good.
Where was when the fishing with John? Was that on IFC or something like that? Like
it might have been. It was like either IFC or Bravo or.
It was on IFC and Bravo.
Yeah, back when Bravo was like
what you said, the Criterion Collection.
Before Bravo went all, you know, reality TV shows and all the nonsense that they do now.
Two scripted programs that we call reality TV. Yeah
exactly. I'm in the middle of two. One ends tonight, which I'll watch over the weekend, is on Apple Plus, Losing Alice, which I talked about, the Israeli show.
Right.
And that's a psychodrama that's been really good. Nice. The other one I'm watching is that I kind of got hooked on. It's another Scandinavian show. It's called Rita.
Do you have any lutefisk when you're watching?
Oh, yeah. That's on my list of things to watch. I haven't watched it yet.
It's a Netflix original, and it's about a woman who's like early 40s. She's a school teacher. It seems like a public school where there's like kindergartners all the way to high schoolers in one of the school. And she's that anarchist teacher who smokes at lunchtime and is having an affair with having a relationship with the principal and tells them what the real world's about and doesn't hold any punches. She's got three kids and one's going to be a dad and daughter can't figure out what she wants to be. And she, by the way, she's single, the mom, Rita. And you follow her life through this era where she's has relationships, no relationships, trying to help kids out in school, doesn't want to follow the rules, you know, but it's got this Swedish thing going on, right? Or actually, it's from Denmark, so it's Danish. And I watch it with subtitles, and it's really good. She's great. I was actually reading about her name is Millie Dinneson. She's the lead actress. And she wears tight jeans to school. She dresses unlike any other teacher. But she's trying to get kids on the right path in her own way and bucking all the rules. And it's written really well. She's got her
lots of problems, not horrible problems, but she's maybe some depression going on. I'm on season two. I think there's five seasons. She's won the best actress for the show once or twice, at least. I think the show's won some awards in Denmark. So I highly recommend it so far. I don't know how it's going to keep going, but I liked it. So Rita on Netflix. All right. Are we still on the same whiskey? Are we going to move on or before our next topic?
I got to tell you, I just moved on. And I am absolutely. I wish you have no idea how much I wish you could smell what I could smell right now.
Oh, skinny.
One more thing. What I might rewatch. Banshee just dropped on HBO Max.
It did. Yeah. all seasons.
Yeah, all seasons. Have you watched it, Mike?
Well, unfortunately, I got like two seasons in. And then the boys got to be too old to keep watching Banshee anymore. Once they get to stay up later, then you know my TV viewing gets curtailed.
I've never seen it.
Oh, it's insane.
I watched it on Amazon, not Cinemax. Did it get moved to Amazon?
Yeah, it was on Amazon. Now I think Amazon lost the rights to it, and I guess Cinemax brought it into the HBO brought it into the fold.
Oh, got it.
Because it was a Cinemax property. Have you watched Warrior, Greg?
No.
Oh, that's good too. Also by Jonathan Tropper. Supposedly it's based on a Bruce Lee story. It's kind of what he pitched back in the early 70s when they were making Kung Fu. Oh, it's really good.
Before we pivot away from Scandinavia completely, have you guys seen Trapped? It's from a few years ago now.
But what is that?
It's an Icelandic show. I think it's on Amazon. I'm pretty sure it's on Amazon. The whole premise is just great. There's a blizzard in Iceland. And there's one cop in this little remote town, and a body washes up on shore right when a cruise ship is docking there. And he has to impound the entire cruise ship full of people while there's a blizzard on, and there's no other police that can come to help him. And he's trying to solve this crime before the cruise ship leaves. It's all sort of set in real time during a blizzard in Iceland.
Oh, wow.
I've only seen the first series, and I know they did a second one. And but I really, really loved the first one. I think my wife found it a bit grim.
I think it's on really? It's on Amazon, it looks like.
Yeah, it's on Amazon. Yeah, that's where I saw it.
Oh, that looks interesting.
The body washing up on the shore wasn't fun enough for her.
It was
a little too grim.
It wasn't laugh out loud.
Yeah, so it's on Prime.
Oh, okay, cool.
You know, I'm two aisles in and I hate you. I hate you.
It's all good. All right, what are we moving on to now, Aaron?
I'm going to get another drink here. I am going to, I got these samples for little bottles that we poured last night at this whiskey tasting that we had. So I'm just going to pour some Redbreast. Just 12.
Excellent.
Never can go wrong with that one.
I'm going to nurture this Octomore.
Ugh, love the Octomores.
You're at the end. There's no more. You have to, right? You'll get a second glass and drink another whiskey while you're just still nursing that one.
Well, I'm going to move on to an 8-year-old Port Escaig.
Okay, we're moving on. This came up in our little email chat. What makes a show stay with us? Why does it stay in our mind? What are the components of a show to make it memorable for someone? Is it moments in the show or thematic? Is it the writing, the acting, the actors, the look of the show? And I think that was a really interesting topic because we all have these memories of shows from our childhood 30, 40 years ago. Like I talked about Fast Times. Shows when you were little kids, you still remember them. But why do you remember them? What makes them so memorable?
To me, I think a lot of it is if you got the syndication, it's everywhere. So as a kid, you watched The Partridge Family, The Brady Bunch, Gilligan's Island, and they were everywhere. I never saw them in the first run. I saw them all in syndication, but they were everywhere. And then as a kid, the stuff you saw was, you had a block of television for ABC, and then you had a block of television for NBC, and it was the must-watch TV, and Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, and Three's Company. And then you went off and you saw, as you got older, it was Cosby Show and Cheers, everything you followed after that. I mean, it was just repetition.
So I'm going to go back to your Partridge Family and your Brady Bunch examples for a second because I saw them first run. And
because you're old.
Because I'm old. And the memory for me, the thing about them, well, Partridge Family is two things. Music, of course.
Susan Day.
Music and Susan Day. But for those two shows specifically, the thing that I think of when you said them, I didn't know you were going to bring this up, I thought of color.
Yeah.
They felt really in color. There were vibrant colors. It was early 70s. There was color in their clothing. There was color in the sets. I will never forget the colors that came from those shows and the music for Parker's Family. The bell bottoms, the hair colors, the style, those were the things more than the content of the show.
I mean, I think there's a difference between why things last for me as an adult versus why shows from my childhood still last. You know, there's a sort of a nostalgia that's baked into some. I'll give you an example. About a month ago, I think I'd had a couple too many drams one night, and I went on iTunes and I bought the entire series of WKRP in Cincinnati.
We talked about
Fever, Venus Flytrap,
the turkey episode.
That's a great Lonnie Anderson.
It's a great show. It's a great old school sitcom that just works, like that. All the interlocking pieces, you know, you can. It's one of those shows. A lot of those old sitcoms. You could tell me two characters, and I could tell you how the scene was going to play between those two characters because they all had a sort of, you know, interlocking mechanism that this is, you know, going to work this way. And
as God is my witness,
turkeys could fly.
But that, is that more nostalgia for you for that, a show like that?
I mean, it's hard for me to say. I mean, I was little when that show came out. You know, I watched it, but I was little. I don't think I got a lot of it, you know, and I thought I was getting it. But I was old enough to know I was not getting it. You know what I mean? Like you kind of.
Yep.
And there's something I loved about it. And it was just this sort of, there was this kind of joyfulness to that show that I really, really still like. I've been watching it and I'm still enjoying it.
How does it hold up? Does it hold up pretty well?
Well, yeah. I mean, it would be a very different show.
Well, in terms of enjoyability. I mean, you enjoy watching.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
Okay. Each person played a particular character that I think holds up in terms of, like, you could see these people still existing somewhere with maybe the guy that played the station manager. He's maybe the weakest character.
You could make that show today.
The Maytag guy.
And it would be about Spotify or something. You know what I mean? And you could just kind of populate it with those same kinds of characters. And
no, I don't mean Gordon Jump, the station owner. I mean the guy who actually ran the station.
Gary Sandy. Yeah.
Gary Sandy. Where his character, like, he might be at the time he had the best characters, but now he might be the weakest character, where you still see all the characters, all the crazy people, and his character is like, yeah, he was okay. You know, but Howard Hessman was tremendous. Tim Reed was tremendous. The guy playing Les Nessman, he's just crazy. Herb Tarlick. I mean, they're crazy characters. I work in a business that has a lot of salespeople. We have a bunch of Herb Tarlicks that walk around, and you're just like, for years, how are you successful?
I think for that show, when you say that, because I remember it quite well, I think of two things: nostalgia, because it's so long ago. For, of course, the music content of it is just the first thing I think of, right? Johnny going crazy when he'd throw a record on. The posters on the wall of real bands. Yeah. That was kind of unheard of. And now you probably can't do it because of rights issues. And you know, it's, remember how Freaks and Geeks could never come to DVD because of the rights issues, right? Those are the things that kind of just stick out to me. The humor was great. I mean, Howard Hessman is just amazing.
And aside from the humor and everything, the thing that they did, the Who concert.
Yeah. They were
one of
the
first shows that did a topical reference to something.
That's right.
Like a tragedy that happened.
Yep.
Where it was like their moment of silence for this horrible thing, because general admission tickets were the thing.
In Cincinnati, yeah.
And look what happened.
Yeah.
And after that, general admission tickets went away, and you couldn't do that anymore because the Who concert was a horrible turn of events.
Yeah.
But so that was the first time it was a topical reference that rolled into a show you were actually watching, and you were like, oh, wait, I read about that.
The other thing I was going to say about it, too, is there was an episode about Venus getting busted for being a draft dodger.
Yeah.
It was kind of in Vietnam, and it was just that show, I thought, did a very good job of getting a serious topic and still getting a huge belly laugh out of it when they take him to court and they depose him, and he says his name is I can't remember Venus's real name. He says his real name, and Mr. Carlson says, Venus, that's not going to work.
Well, what I also thought was interesting was Gordon Jump plays like an old school. He was in the military. He's, you know, straight and narrow, and he views him as being a draft dodger. And then when he figures out, like, wait, you actually saw more combat than I did, and what you saw was horrible, and the whole tune changes. And then it's, you know, now I'm behind you 100% because, my God, man, how could you possibly get by with what you saw? it was just a really well-written episode, and it was so well acted between those two characters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was a great ensemble cast, right? And that was the era of that kind of thing where you had this. It wasn't three people. It was whatever there was, 7, 8, 9, 10 people in that cast.
And they all had a role.
Yeah. Everyone had a role. Some people had an episode they had was all about Bailey Quarters, and some episodes you wouldn't see her, for 2 seconds. It was a great group of people.
It wasn't groundbreaking, I don't think. No. It wasn't All in the Family or one of those shows that was truly, super edgy. It just kind of worked and was fun. But, but then, like I said earlier, in contrast to WKRP is The Wire. I watched it when it was on and I loved it. And now I'm rewatching it and I love it every bit as much. And I'm just astounded at this sort of virtuosic storytelling.
We have that question a lot. Do things hold up? And why do they hold up? And The Wire, what's that, 10 years ago?
It came out around the time of Sopranos, like season two or season three. Probably 2002, 2001. And it ended around 2010.
20 years ago and 10 years from the last episode.
It ended in 06.
It ended in 06.
No, it ended in 08. 2002 to 2008. Yeah. Sorry.
Right, because they had some pretty big spans between seasons. That was just a great show. And what was great about the show is it was efficient. And there was really no wasted time or wasted anything. Everything mattered. Every little detail counted. And it eventually shows up. So even if you think about something like, 10 episodes back, it comes back to haunt you.
I found it interesting how that each season was almost like a new show, yet it all sort of characters kind of keep sticking together. The grittiness of it. Oh, Greg's happy. He just finished. Or no, maybe he's not happy.
Yeah.
That Octomore.
Bittersweet.
Bittersweet. For me, that show is memorable for the writing.
Oh, the writing was fantastic. The acting was great.
Everything. The acting. Like that, again, we talked earlier about some movies being like a who's who. That The Wire was tremendous. I mean, you look at that cast, and everyone in that cast has gone on to do something else. Uh-huh. It's just really, really well done.
Think back to like crime drama from before that, crime dramas of TV.
Beretta.
Well, so that's actually an interesting one, because Beretta tried to be a show gritty. In the 70s that was gritty.
Yeah.
It was all trying to be something kind of the seedier side of Los Angeles, right? Contrast that with what The Wire is, which is trying to be even more realistic in with crime in Baltimore, Philly, wherever it is. It's kind of the same thing, but it's done completely differently. Yeah. Now, granted, you've got network TV versus you've got cable TV, and you can go 100 miles an hour on cable. And David Chase can go farther along language-wise and content-wise today than he could do 30, 40 years ago. But they're trying to get to the same place in a different way. But the grittiness still is there. But we're just used to a different kind of grittiness now. Now we want real grittiness. We want Gamora. We want The Wire. For me, the grittiness really sticks out.
Years ago on KCRW, I heard an interview with David Simon, and he talked about they benefited on that show from being always one of the afterthought shows on HBO. They were that show was on when The Sopranos was at its peak, when Sex and the City was at its peak. They never needed to be the one that made money rain down on HBO.
So
they
were always,
and he was,
he could do whatever he wanted.
Yeah. Although he did say he spent 5 years on the brink of being canceled at any moment.
He needed a Huggy Bear. If Antonio Fargas had been on that show, that would have really automatic renewals. Yeah.
I saw him. He this was very funny. A few months ago on Twitter, Michael B. Jordan was named the sexiest man alive.
That's funny.
And David Simon wrote a whole thing about how he's like, I'd like to point out that the first two major acting jobs for both Idris Elba and Michael B. Jordan were The Wire, which means that I am smart enough to identify the sexiest men in the world, but I'm dumb enough to kill them off.
That's funny.
Funny.
That was a tremendous cast. I mean, look at Michael K. Williams now.
Yeah.
He's just
Wendell
great.
Pierce?
Yeah, Wendell Pierce.
And, Michael K. Williams. What's his name? The Lance Reddick.
Just his scenes that he steals in all the John Wick movies.
Oh, he's great. He's really good.
Well, he was in, staying.
He was in Oz before he was in The Wire, and he was like an undercover cop in a couple episodes of Oz. So he's been around. I guess once you get into the HBO system, which I mean, I guess is sort of like an old studio system to a degree.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe it's because of, you know, what we said before about the casting agents and all that. You know, they have their talent pool. They know these guys are good or women are good. Mm-hmm. They're going to bring them in again.
Yeah, there's a lot of actors that you see from one HBO show to another to another to another. Oh, my God.
I mean, Michael K. Williams has been on like four, I think, because he was in The Wire. He was on The Night of.
Boardwalk Empire.
And he just did Lovecraft Country. So, you know, once you're in the system, that's probably not a bad place to be. You want to be a working actor.
But, I've never seen a TV show, maybe kind of Game of Thrones, but I've never seen another show like The Wire where they would the main three actors in this season will be basically bit players in the next season. Like they just completely revolve, you know, the point of view of the roles the characters play.
It's a great show. It's a really, really good show. I was rewatching it for a little while and then, you know, other things pop up. So
will we say the same thing 10, 15 years from now about it? Will it still have that longevity and feeling for us in the future?
I don't know.
I think that's the question about why shows stick around to us.
I mean, the Sopranos was the game changer, right? I mean, that kind of just changed everything in terms of...
For cable TV, I'd say yes.
Right. Yeah. That kind of launched premium TV. And I was kind of like, I thought it was going to be kind of cheesy with Sopranos. But maybe about a year in, I think I jumped in on season two. And then I went back and did a rewatch, you know, because that was back when I think Netflix was just delivering DVDs to your house.
Yeah.
And we watched the first season. And I got to say, that pilot episode of The Sopranos is fantastic. I mean, they pack so much story into an hour, introducing all the characters and all the storylines and just kind of setting it up. Once you really sit down and watch it, that was a really fantastic pilot.
Is it the pilot?
And the same thing, the cast involved. Gandolfini, just alone, Gandolfini, he's a tremendous actor.
He was great.
Oh, who are we going to get to play his wife? Oh, let's just get this other, you know, Edie Falcón. She's unbelievable. And the people filling out the family were great. I mean, everything about it was just, you know, they really did a top-notch job rolling out the cast.
Well, the good thing with that, the thing with that show was, to me, to a degree, there was a bit of diminishing returns as it kind of went along. But the core of that show was always Tony and Carmela. They were just so good together. I mean, they were really, really good together. That's what kind of kept me going for seven seasons.
Well, ultimately, it's a show about family, right? So,
absolutely.
Right? And they're the classic, but they are the husband and wife trying to keep the family together. Trying to keep themselves together individually and collectively. And I think if you strip away all the other stuff, that's what you've got. And people can relate to that. Mm-hmm. Throw in all the other stuff and it makes it more dramatic. And
right. I mean, they're dealing with, he's trying to run a business, if you will.
Yeah.
And he's got the kids and the kids are wild cards. And
they're driving him nuts. And so he's kind of losing it. And it's no different than most of America, the world, people trying to keep their lives together. Oh, yeah, by the way, I'm also, leader of a
mob boss in New Jersey.
They may have to kill a few people along the way.
But, go ahead, Greg.
No, I was just going to say something quick about what you said about the diminishing returns. I think that's the thing that David Simon, in essence, was talking about with The Wire, never had those pressures. I think The Sopranos was probably under enormous pressure to top itself every year. Mm-hmm. Enormous pressure, you know, and how are you going to do this? How are you going to ramp this up?
Well, Game of Thrones, similarly, I think.
And I think initially the show was about the guy who's got family pressure and business pressure. And, oh, by the way, he's a mobster and he sees a psychiatrist. And by like the third year, the psychiatrist was out of it and you never heard from her again. And it was all about the inner workings of the North Jersey mob.
Is it the pilot?
Because of that pressure, they were like, no, get rid of that. We don't want him on the couch. We want him to be like he's got to be the godfather kind of thing.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. It became The Godfather, a stylish modern.
Where The Wire was like, no one's paying attention. Do whatever you want.
The therapist thing is interesting because there's been therapist shows in television for a long time, but you didn't see it with people that were criminals. That was a changer here. Forget what the criminal was, but it was a criminal. It was a bad person. And then it's the beginning, I think, like you said, Ange, it's a game changer. It's sort of the beginning of the anti-hero and all the ways up to Bryan Cranston, right, in Breaking Bad. And that just becomes this revolving thing in the last 20 years, because since, I think, Sopranos. And that character became so much bigger than we ever would have ever thought of from previous eras of television, where the good guy's the good guy, and that's it. And that's who we love. Yeah. The bad guy's a bad guy. We can't like him. But now we can like a bad guy.
And the white hats and the black hats. We know who's good because he's wearing a white hat. Now this, it's all, right.
It was all
he's
gray.
A black hat, but it's not his fault. He doesn't need to be a black hat.
He's dealing with depression and his wife's annoying and blah, 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 right? Yeah.
Mike, what's that? What's that one kid's movie? Wreck-It Ralph? Just because I am bad guy doesn't mean I am bad guy.
You're a bad guy.
Well, you know, I remember reading a thing at the time of the peak Sopranos-ness about that Tony Soprano was the first antihero to tip the scales on the negative. That you would always have these, you know, starting in the 70s, you had lots of movies and TV characters where they would be, a good cop but flawed, or this but flawed, you know. And this was the first major character where the flaws outweighed the good.
There's no redemption.
Yeah. Was it the pilot of The Sopranos, or was it just the first season episode where he finally stands up to his mother and then he falls off the front porch and his gun falls out of his pocket? It's such an amazing shot because it's like there's no dialogue to it, but you just know everything about this character. You know what I'm talking about? He's trying to leave his mom's house and he falls down the stairs.
Yeah. He's the boss. And then his mom gets his uncle to try to whack him.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a shame she died in real life because she was such an amazing character.
Well, you know, that's
What a difference from when she's on Lou Grant.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, when she's on The Sopranos, you're like, that's the same woman? Unbelievable. Uh-huh.
The first season, though, I think could have stood alone by itself. If they would have ended after the first season, it would have been like the greatest 13 episodes of television.
Yeah.
Because they were just so tight.
Yeah.
You know, and that last episode, the last episode of the first season, where I think she's in the hospital and she's got the mask on her face and they're going through the hall in the hospital and he's right beside her because he thinks she's going to die. And she's just laughing at him the whole time. And you see the panic on his face. It was just a fantastic final scene.
Do any of you guys know David Jacobs?
I don't know. No. Give me a little more. I might.
He's a friend of mine, but he's also, he was the creator of Dallas, creator of Knott's Landing.
Yes.
So he's sort of become like a bit of a mentor and friend of mine. And he told me a very funny thing about, I don't know David Chase. I've never met David Chase, but he told me that he said for years in the 90s, every year David Chase had a pilot and it never got picked up. And David Jacobs told me that he said he would see David Chase at various places and he would say, hey, you know, it's a shame about your show, but you know, it was a great idea. You know, next year. And he said, David Chase would always go, meh. And then he said, then The Sopranos happened and he finally saw him and he said, hey, he said, that's amazing. I can't, you know, it must be so exciting for you. And he went, meh. and he said, he realized a deeper level of him than he'd ever known up till that point was just in this one sort of nonverbal gesture.
I think that Sopranos has those TV moments that when you think back at a TV show, why it still sticks with you. I think Sopranos has those moments. Much like The Godfather has those moments, and not just because they're mob movies. I always think about the bear in North, wherever they are in Jersey, and that bear is kind of like, you know, in Tony's life, running around. The strip joint?
The bada bing.
The bada bing.
It's not the strip joint that makes that interesting to me, but where the strip joint is, it's on the side of this, wherever it is, you guys would know where that, you know, that interstate or something, some road. It's not pretty. It's not nice. It's just the side of a road. It's like road, almost like roadhouse. It's just there. And it's just, it's gritty. That's those scenes and those settings that kind of make me go back to those kinds of shows.
You know, it's funny. My wife is from the town where The Sopranos is sort of set, like the town one over from where she's from in New Jersey is where the actual plot of being was the satin dolls, I think is what it was really called. But I remember her showing it to me. She's like, that's the bot of being over there. And down in this town here is the pork store.
Yeah. Satriels.
Oh, Satriels.
Here's Satriels. Let's stay here for a month. Make it two.
Was that the whole thing when they had to, they ran the guy through the meat grinder?
Ran the guy through the grinder.
Yeah, I was thinking about that because what was it? Christopher couldn't eat there for like, because he was grinding the guy through. He's like, oh, I can't do that. But yeah, I mean, with TV shows, it's different. I mean, sometimes it's the look, sometimes it's the characters. I mean, I latch on the characters, you know, ultimately, because that's who you're following, you know. But then some shows just bring it, just put things up to a different level, like Better Call Saul or Breaking Bad. The characters were good, but the visuals were unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, the time lapse in those two shows that they would just shoot, whatever they're doing, whether it's, you know, Jimmy doctoring documents to frame his brother, or, you know, all the crazy stuff that Walter White would do. I don't know how they orchestrated that stuff.
It was crazy. I think Breaking Bad's interesting because it maybe is the first, aside from the ongoing anti-hero mm-hmm. thing going on. There's a bit of a farce that's ongoing. We talk about this, Ange, a lot, like Sneaky Pete. If you strip away the
shenanigans,
is this farce that's ongoing. Okay, I have to get this done. If I don't get it done by midnight, then this is going to happen. If I don't get this done by then, this person's going to die. And if I don't do this, it's this ongoing spaghetti mess of stuff that has to happen. And
you just described my whole week.
Well, there you go.
Right? The only person that dies at the end is me.
And that is like an ongoing thematic pattern in television now. Ozark, same thing. These guys have to fix 12 things so they don't get killed by the end of the episode or by the end of the season. And it's, oh no, and she found out that I'm also going to X, Y, and Z to launder money by noon tomorrow, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is like this ongoing way of telling stories now. And I kind of get a little tired of it. Lupin's the same way. There's all these little twists and turns that all have to catch up to each other. That's become a part of television now. And I think Breaking Bad sort of was the beginning of all that. It's not ending, I don't think. And not
so, you're more of a fan of the straight line instead of the dotted line. You want to see the beginning, the middle, and the end, as opposed to the beginning, the middle, and then a whole lot of more middles, and then the end.
Yeah.
Where there's just too much going on. I don't disagree. I think some of these things, they almost overcomplicate themselves to point where you're like, that was an hour of just wasted television here. We didn't need that one.
Well, the convolutedness, you talked about that show early on, Mike, about, I can't remember the name of it. You said you're on your third episode with Katherine Heigl.
Firefly Lane.
Oh. The first episode, I couldn't get through because it was the going back and forth between the different ages of these two women. I was so confused. Are these daughters? Who are they daughters of? Are they daughters of themselves? Yeah. Are they the grandparents of themselves? It was so.
Yeah. It was crazy. Unnecessary. It was just totally unnecessary.
Tell a story. It's okay to tell a story in a straight line. I'm saying that with the director here in the room.
If you have a flashback, make it have a point.
Yes. You don't have to go zigzagging 50 different.
You know what? You know my wife's biggest complaint was? They're supposed to flash from the early 2000s back to the early to mid 80s. And her complaint was the hairstyles aren't right. Those are the hairstyles from the 70s. The person who put this together ruined the flashbacks. Like this, I don't want to watch this anymore because that's not the 80s. That's the 70s. They got Farrah hairstyles. That's the 70s. That's the whole show's wrong. Just shut it down.
It's funny how I think television has changed so much from the 60s and 70s and 50s. That was all straight line TV.
Yeah.
Beginning, middle, and an end. Very simple. It's not that simple anymore. Now there are 14 middles and 25 ends and a million beginnings to every episode. And it's,
if they did Cheers now, we would have to see three or four flashbacks to Ted Danson pitching for the Red Sox. We get it. You're not a pitcher anymore. We're done. You're Mayday Malone. We don't care. Move on.
I've said this before. Maybe the worst word that has ever come into television is backstory.
Right. Long backstory short.
Oh, my God. Every ensemble show has to have a backstory on every cast member.
Single character.
And maybe the beginning of that was Lost. Lost was obviously complicated, but
that was another stinker.
20 cast members, and you had to find it. You had to learn about each of their backstories.
That was where you wrote a show for a year that you never thought would get picked up, and 4 years in, you have no way to end it. Yeah. What am I supposed to do now?
I watched it all and I thought, is it going on because the network wants it to go on? Does JJ want us to go on? I don't know that he wants it to go on.
He had no idea how to end it.
Maybe we want to.
We get picked up again? Oh, my God.
Oh, no. Wait, we have to come up with more craziness? How do we do that? We only had enough for 1 year.
Exactly. I mean, it's like this podcast, right?
Exactly.
We can do another episode.
It's still going on again? I thought they canceled that.
It's a book I have. It's in LA, and it's called Screenwriting Revisited. I think it's called some generic title like that. And it's all about nonlinear storytelling. It's an Australian film professor. And, you know, she talks about sort of, you know, traditional storytelling being a line or an arc. And now it's sort of more like a paisley and everything has to collapse in on itself. And she's not criticizing it. She's actually sort of talking about how to do it and how scenes are tied to one another in the best cases and how they work.
And when it's done well, it's really good. But when they do it just for the sake of doing it, you're like, why? That was unnecessary. Just move on. When you recast Batman, I do not need to see his parents killed again and him fall into a well that was a deep hole filled with bats. I don't. I get it. Batman is Batman. Move on. We don't need that. Peter Parker doesn't need to get bit by the radioactive spider every time you put a new person in the Peter Parker suit. I don't need to see that.
So with this style of writing and storytelling go away at some point and revert back to something more linear?
It's a good question. I don't know.
I don't know.
But I do. I do know two examples that she uses throughout her book of movies that do it really, really well, and I think they both hold up. Is Remains of the Day,
sure,
and Shine. Remains of the Day is Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson. Shine is Jeffrey Rush, the piano player.
What was the one Soderbergh movie with Terrence Stamp? And he comes back to avenge his daughter.
That actually was very good. And
Limey.
And they used old film footage of him from another movie.
Yeah.
So it was actually him flashback. It was really him. It wasn't some guy playing Terrence Stamp.
He did a really good job with the flashbacks in that and Out of Sight. They were both really well done. I'm a little obsessed with that.
Sometimes I feel it's trite, and it's an easy way to take 3 minutes out of the bigger story. Right. And I do get tired of it. What's that Spanish show, Ange, we watched? Money Heist.
Money Heist.
You got to learn about their backstories. And
I like the first two seasons. After that, when they did the second heist, I'm like, all right, I'm done. I'm exhausted.
I still like it. I'm talking about the story.
Like Tokyo.
I do like Tokyo. Tokyo in the spring.
Tokyo on the beach in a bikini.
There we go. Hey now. all right, guys. Any other last thoughts on what we're watching, what we're going to watch?
COVID has killed a lot of network television, and they're coming back in dribs and drabs, and I can't wait for some of this stuff to come back.
Yeah. It's, great. Is your background more like television or more making just like movies?
I mean, I've never worked in episodic television. I've worked in movies and a lot of commercial stuff. And, you know, I have a lot of friends who work in episodic television, but I never have. I actually, the way I became friends with David Jacobs is he and I were developing we got the rights to this amazing book called Vienna 1814. And this is going to sound really boring until I tell you the second part of it. It's about the Congress of Vienna. Which was basically the summit in Europe to decide what to do with Europe after Napoleon. And the entire thing was such a complete and absolute abject failure that it was just, David's fond of saying, it's just a bunch of feasting and fucking. all the aristocrats who had been kind of repressed by Napoleon for 20 years got together and just had an enormous party, so much so that Napoleon snuck off of Elba and took over France again. And it led to Waterloo. That's the climax of the series. And the book is absolutely amazing. Like all these would-be princesses are actually basically prostitutes, but they have titles and they're courtiers, but there's no court. That was my kind of foray into episodic television. David and I developed this whole mini series and it was just too expensive. We were never able to get it going.
That's got to cost a fortune.
Isn't that Bridgerton? No, that's not
the same thing. I mean, the entire thing, it was just one ball scene after another, you know? And then the climax is freaking Waterloo.
Do you mean a large dance scene when you say dance?
Yes, I was going to say the same thing. You're a bad man.
We're, what we're seeing here.
That's what I meant.
I think that's something my wife would be all over with. She'd be fascinated by this period stuff. She loves Bridgerton. She loves Outlander. If you throw some frilly gowns on people, she's all, well, we got to watch this.
Cool, and one of the cool things, too, is that it was Vienna was basically a police state at the time. Austria was a police state. And it was considered to be the invention of modern spying. Like, there was one guy who was, like, in charge of the Austrian police. And he had, like, 130 spies on his payroll that were all butlers and maids and stuff for these people. Every day it was amazing just going to work with him and sort of putting this together. And it absolutely was devastating to both of us. We just couldn't get it going. And, you know, he really felt like, and I think he's probably right, that just no one would ever say it, but it was just that he was too old for people to trust him to run a show that expensive. And I've never run a show in my life. And, you know, so.
Shonda,
you
know, bring in Shonda.
Yeah.
You said spies. There was actually a show that I was going to mention earlier about something to watch. There's a new show. I think it's a doc. It's like a 6-part doc on Netflix called Spycraft.
And oh, yeah. How is that?
I haven't seen it. I mean, it's on my list of things to watch. And it's about the science of spying. And I think there's like an episode about wiretapping. And there's an episode.
Is there a shoe phone? Is there a shoe phone?
There might be a shoe. There may be a shoe phone. There may be a cone of silence.
Cone of silence.
I'm not sure. I've told the story
before. I think it might be a show about good spycraft.
No. As far as we know.
Henry Spycraft.
As far as we know, yes. Well, boys, this was fun. Another episode.
Well, thanks for coming,
Greg.
Yeah, Greg.
No, thank you. I really appreciate it. It was fun.
You are welcome anytime.
So, again, great show. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google, Stitcher, Audible, Spotify, and, of course, visit us on boozedancing.com. And also, if you have any questions, comments, or topics you'd like us to discuss, email us at boozedancing@gmail.com. So, gents, it was a pleasure.
What we watch when we drink, episode 10 is in the books.
Cheers.
Cheers,
boys.
Cheers. Cheers.